four will know that we are recording all of the sessions and keeping the presentations, which then go on the Fairfield website. And there are people, including our WIP manager, who can't get to any of the Thursday nights but is up to following it quite closely on the web. So welcome everybody, well done for finding the room, managing to park, not getting into some literary event and being here. Fire escape is fairly straightforward. Down the front doors, the way you came in, is one way out. The other way out is going to the left out of this door, and then right at the end of the corridor, which brings you out opposite the castle. It also happens to take you past the toilet, so that's on that one as well. We have been asked about hearing loop, and unfortunately, this room doesn't have that system. So I'm just hoping if anyone knows that they might be worried about that, I'm hoping that they've sit sat near the front. And if you find wanting to say something over again, you could just ask them. Yeah, okay. So I'd like to welcome Ian to this lecture. Last time we had Claire Harris, who was our Natural England advisor, talking about the role of Natural England in promoting environmental schemes, and in particular talking about the Fairfield Management Plan. So Ian's talk is in some ways a follow-on from that, where he's looking at the most, perhaps the most visible signs of our success, and talking about the birds that we are attracting, and why what we're doing on Fairfield is very important for the survival of those species. So I'll hand over to you.
Thank you very much. I should point out that I'm no great expert on birds, but a few years ago when I retired, I started getting interested in birds. And obviously this Fairfield project has been a very nice way of being involved. I run the indoor birding sessions for the U3A, and last week we had a talk by Richard Staughton from the RSPB there about a lot of the work that has actually gone on in Fairfield to create the environment. So I won't be talking about that apart from summarising in a slide. I've been largely referring to birds themselves. So I'm going to start off by talking about some of the national problems that we have. Can you hear me at the back?
Yeah,
very good. Okay, some national trends. Now, since the Second World War, we've lost about 50 million birds. In particular, there's been a sharp decline in the numbers of farm birds. I don't know whether you can see this, but this shows a bar of 100 here and dates from 1980 through to just over 2005. And you can see that all birds are not doing too badly, perhaps down about 10% over that period of time. But farmland birds are nearly down to 50%. So we have a real problem with farmland birds. Now, 50 to 70 years ago, farming, of course, was mixed with adjacent arable and livestock and plentiful hedges and ponds. So, I'm going to talk about agricultural intensification for the next couple of slides to see what's actually changed in the last 50 to 70 years that is the background to this drop in bird, farmer bird numbers. The first, of course, is the loss of mixed farming. Most farms in the past have both got livestock and arable crops, providing open nesting sites for the young. If you look at the pattern of Britain today, you'll see that arables in the east and pasture and livestock in the west. You know, in the past, small farms had all that together. The second point, of course, is the switch from spring to autumn sowing of cereals. This gives rise to the loss of overwinter stubble, which provides food and shelter between harvest and mid-February. Moving on to a third major factor, is increase in chemical usage. Farmers use fertilizers as well as about 350 different licensed pesticides, herbicides and fungicides, which themselves of course they impact on weed, insect and invertebrate populations, and these are of course all food for birds. I'll come back to one or two examples of this later. And then of course we've got other aspects of more intensive farming methods. In 1992, the EU decreed, this was a time when we had food mountains and wine lakes, probably we don't remember so well now, but in 1992, the EU decreed that farmers set aside 15% of all cropped farmland for wildlife. A few years later, that figure was reduced to 10%, and in 2008, this whole system was scrapped. Now, there'd been some continuation of set-aside land in terms of Natural England, higher level stewardship, what have you, but nothing on the scale that was implemented in these years. So, let's take a look at how we classify the risk to birds. And I'm just going to have a couple of slides here to point out two different ways of two different criteria, if you like. This slide is all about trends, long-term trends by which we can assign birds to red, amber, or green lists. If you look at the number of species, the sum of 52, 126, and 68 is 248 British birds. Right? This is the list of birds that we regard as British birds. And if you look at the proportions here, you'll see that 21% of our birds are on the red list, and I'll come back to the precise meaning of that in a moment. About half the birds are on the amber list, looks a bit yellow in this, and 68 species are still on the green list. Now, there are a large number of classifications of the red list, but the simplest one is a criterion that looks at least 50% decline in the breeding population over the last 25 years. There are a number of other, perhaps 10 other criteria that can be looked at, but this is the simplest one. It gives you an idea that the population has declined by more than 50% in 25 years. So we're looking at a trend here, right? This is a trend, not absolute numbers. If I tell you about house sparrows, there's millions of them around, but they're on the red list because the trend is that they're down in numbers. Other birds might be quite small in number. If you look at the stone curlew, there are 350 pairs in the country. But that's moved off the red list onto the amber list because the trends are going the other way. So the trend is the one thing, and that's what takes us to look at red, which is worse than 50% decline in 25 years, or it might be the decline in breeding range, for instance. Amber obviously is the lesser decline, and green is okay. The other way of looking at it is something that's been introduced by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. And this criterion is proximity to extinction. And they set up a very nice scale here, which is least concerned, near threatened, vulnerable, endangered, critically endangered, extinct in the wild, and then extinct. And if we look at the bird I'm going to talk about, here's the lapwing, it's already moved to vulnerable. If you look at Wikipedia, it's out of date, it still has it as least concern. And of course, if you move on to extinct, they see the great hawk. So you can see that Here we're looking at a different matter. We're looking at how birds move from here to there. There are a number of other ways of looking at the whole problem, but I think this gives you an idea of how we classify bird populations. Now, fortunately, Fairfield, although we think of it as a nature reserve, is effectively farmland, the very thing that we need. It's not very big, I have to say. But we have that wonderful mix of arable, livestock, orchard, pasture, ponds, wet grassland. You probably can't see it in this photograph. I managed to take this photograph when some sheep had broken into our field there, which we hastily had removed. And if you look at this map here, you can see, I don't know whether you can recognise any parts of Fairfield here, but we have the marshy land around here. Cattle grazing might be pretty well anywhere. The orchard area up here, wet pasture there, woodland quite small here, arable was quite extensive this year, a hay meadow here, and numerous ponds. So Fairfield is effectively farmland, and we have a way of addressing some of these problems. So this is rather a heavy slide, I apologize for this. What I've tried to do is put into this slide everything that Richard Staughton taught me in a 1-hour lecture last week about what's happened in Fairfield. So you can imagine it's going to be very condensed. And there it is. So what's happened? We've raised the water levels and made a new reed bed area. You have to understand that in farming over the last 50 to 70 years, farmers have tended to reduce the height of water levels, they've drained land. We've created ponds and ditches and scrapes. Scrapes are ideal for giving areas for invertebrates that can be fed upon by lapwing, etc. We planted an arable crop, which I believe was a wheat oak hybrid. We've recently planted more trees in pony wood. We've created some hedges, and we lowered the height of others. The thing about lowering the height of hedges is that some birds, like lapwing, will not nest if they're overlooked. So they don't want to nest in an area where a sparrowhawk can see where they're nesting. So we've had advice on how to lower some hedges. I know that it's upset some people because, you know, a hedge that was very beautiful in the past is now quite low. We've introduced cattle crossing points. We've put in margins with wild bird seed mix and what's called floristically enhanced grass. And we put up nest boxes. And I'm supposed to visit the nest boxes sometime in October, but it hasn't happened yet. So let's have a look at some of the birds I'm going to talk about here. On the red list, right, that means that these birds have declined by more than 50% in 25 years. I'm going to talk about the great partridge and lapwing, the song, and this group, which are all thrushes, song thrush, fieldfare, and redwing. I think I'll give the tree sparrow a miss because there's nothing very positive I can say about that. And on the amber list, but the reed bunting and snipe, which I'll talk about as well. These birds, I should point out, are very close to the red list. The reed bunting just came off the red list in 2009. And I can't understand why the snipe isn't on it, actually. So, let's have a look at the grey partridge. Okay, so this is red listed and vulnerable. You saw where we were on the scale of vulnerable. We're approaching extinction. That's the male. Nice red face. Female, there's rather nice horseshoe markings on the female there, and something of the same on the male. It's a medium size, plump game bird, which is found in lowland arable areas. It feeds on seeds, shoots, and leaves. Sounds like the type of a book. Now, bag records, of course this is a game bird, show that between 1870 and 1930, around 2 million birds were shot annually. So there must have been quite a number of them about. Today, there are 43,000 breeding territories. So let's have a look at grey partridge numbers. I don't know whether you can see the axes here. I've got 1970 here, and right up to beyond 2010 there. This scale reads 1,000 up here, and we're down around 100 now. So you can see there's been a catastrophic decline in the number of grey partridge. The numbers have fallen by greater than 90% in the last 50 years. In fact, when I look at my oldest bird book, it's called the Common Partridge. Now, the causes of decline. Firstly, the introduction of herbicides. This is a common pattern with a lot of birds that we're looking at here. Chick survival rates have fallen. Now, partridge, in common with a lot of other birds, are vegetarians. But nearly all of such birds, with a few exceptions, need to eat insects in the first few weeks of life to get enough protein. And the grey partridge is no exception. And of course, the introduction of organochlorine herbicides like DDT and dieldrin in the 50s eliminated many crop weeds that were, of course, insect food plots. So if you wipe out the insects that the grey partridge chicks need, how are they going to survive? Hedgerows, the situation of course was exacerbated by the removal of grassy nesting cover, as fields were enlarged by removing hedgerows. And then we come on to additional risks. I think you probably will recognize this. This is a female sparrowhawk. They're a great success story. Their numbers are up 400-500% in the last few years. But raptors such as the female sparrowhawk, in areas where grey partridge numbers are low, they're of course in high risk of predation, particularly in late winter where there's nowhere very much to hide. And this is where these margins are very important, because we provide an area where the chicks can effectively hide from birds like the sparrowhawk. So it's important to provide tall cover in February and March. Now, the grey partridge in Fairfield is not a great success story. We did have a pair of grey partridge nesting in the West Field, but as far as I'm aware, they didn't seem to raise chicks. If anyone knows different, I'd be very interested to learn. In August this year, we did release four chicks into the arable field, and although I was there with my camera, they all shot off so fast, you weren't able to see, but there's a tiny bit of white dust there, and that was my fourth attempt. So you'll see my photographic prowess as we go on. So we have released some chicks, and we did at least have some grey partridge in Fairfield, in the West Field. Now lapwing, very handsome bird, red-listed and vulnerable again. So again, red-listed, more than 50% decline in the last 25 years, vulnerable, on its way to extinction. UK breeding numbers, about 140,000 pairs. Now, they're ground nesting birds that breed on wet pastures or farmland, and they feed on insects, spiders, and earthworms. So these are not vegetarians, like the grey partridge. But they do need all sorts of things that will be wiped out by all sorts of chemicals. Their prime habitat is a mosaic where grass and spring tillage fields are close together, precisely the sort of thing that we've lost in the last 50 to 70 years. Left-wing numbers. They're one of the most strongly declining bird species in Europe, having decreased in all countries since 1980. Now, again, I'm not sure how well you can see this here. The proportions are not so dramatic. I've got 1970 through to about 2012 here. Up here we're about 300, and now we've dropped below 100. Now, of course, it is possible to halt and reverse the decline in blackbird numbers by the creation of a mosaic of spring-sown crops and grassland, just as we have done in Fairfield, and managing grazing pressure by making sure that we don't allow the cattle on when they're likely to be nesting and breeding chicks. And of course, maintaining damp areas on unimproved grassland. Now, this year we were lucky. Lapwings bred, and there were two pair of chicks. And this is quite a success story. For those of you with longer memories, you may recall that lapwings did breed in this area probably 15 or more years ago. So this is a very good news. And that's a lapwing chick. It's not a pretty thing, but there we go. And it also achieves one of our targets. This is the Biodiversity Action Plan, so-called, which I haven't bored you with. Now, another bird that's quite interesting is the reed bunting. This is amber-listed, and as I mentioned earlier, in 2009, when the last assessment was made of whether birds should be red, amber, or green, this was removed from the red list and put onto the amber list. 250,000 breeding territories. They're predominantly farmland and wetland birds. This one here is a male. If they're not a male that look like that, you probably wouldn't tell the difference between that and an ordinary sparrow. This is one of the problems. The breeding male is quite distinctive. The juveniles and the females are much less so. Reed buntings have had a strange, rather oscillating population numbers. I've not seen any explanation of this 15-year period history or whatever it is. But you can see there in 2009 they decided to take it off the red list. But, you know, one wonders with this oscillation whether it will not be back on the red list next time round. This year we have had a return to breeding in Fairfield with three males holding territories and two pair breeding. So again, this is another success story of a bird that is amber-listed and right on the edge of being red-listed. The song thrush. Now, this is a bird you can go through half a year and not see one, really. They're very secretive and difficult to find. But of course, if you go back into Victorian times, they were perhaps the most common bird around. And they inspired, it's a red-listed bird, they inspired a lot of poets and what have you to comment on them. I think this one's Robert Browning, that's the wise thrush, he sings his song twice over. But you can find about 20 references in poetry and literature to song thrushes in Victorian times. They eat worms, snails, and fruit. And as you can see, there's a lot of them about, but they're very difficult to see, and they are red listed. You can see here in this table here, let me just tell you in case you can't see, this takes up from about 1970 here across to beyond to about 2012 here. And the song thrush population, as you can see, nosedived in the 70s and 80s, stabilized a little bit. Probably went up a little bit. I suspect this was the set aside scheme that helped them recover somewhat. But of course, that's largely gone by the board now. So song thrush populations are very low. And their decline is linked to first year survival again. Fortunately, two or three pairs have bred in February this year. The other thrush that I won't mention, because we don't have any in Fairfield, although one, this is a missel thrush, one sang in the bottom of Tim's garden for about a month or so, right on the edge of Fairfield. And of course they set up very large territories of about 50 acres, so it's perhaps no great surprise that Fairfield was a bit 50 hectares. So anyway, back to the song thrush. Two or three pairs have bred in Fairfield this year, so that's very good. Now, coming into a couple of wintering thrushes, again, these are red listed, all the, well, the missel thrush is amber listed, but all the other thrushes are red listed. A very handsome bird, about 720,000 birds. As you can see, they largely come from, they're of Scandinavian and Russian origin. And of course, whether they come to us depends very much on what the food supplies and the weather conditions are like over there. Last year, I don't think I saw a single field fare on in Fairfield. I saw a flock in near Coniston, but very few came over. They're social birds, spending the winter in flocks of from a dozen or two to several hundred strong. They're quite an interesting bird to see in flight. They weigh about 130 grams, and if you see them flying, they're the largest bird that does flap bounce. You know, birds, as they proceed upwards in height, larger birds flap and glide, but smaller birds bounce because they get more lift from their chest than they get from their wings. And this bird is quite large, about the size of a collared dove. So when you see a bird that's flat bouncing, that's rather large, it's a field fare. Now, wintering redwing, red listed again. If you get a good view of it, you can see the redwing here, and you've got this very powerful supercilium above the eye that's very recognizable. Again, a few breed in Britain, and wintering numbers are rather similar to the field fare, but of course all that depends very much again on what the conditions are like here, and of course up in Iceland as well, a separate race, if you like, of birds come into Iceland, from Iceland. Both of these thrushes eat berries and fruit, as well as invertebrates. And last year, we had a number of these birds overwintering in Fairfield. I think at any one time, I could go out and find a dozen of them. Now, snipe. Amber-listed. Very handsome. Skulking bird. Breeding numbers about 80,000 pairs, but a lot winter here, over a million birds. As you can see, they swarm in from continental Europe, from Iceland, and if it's really nasty here, they might go further south. These small wading birds of marshes are in decline because of wetland drainage and prey abundance. I think that problem is predator abundance. Anyway, their numbers are in decline. Again, we're looking from about 1975 here through to about 2012 there. You can see we're down to about 100 now. Up here, we're around 1500. So a major decline in numbers of snipe. But our winter flush count was 91 birds in Fairfield, and we're one of the major places for snipe in the northwest of England. So it's a very important site for snipe. Now, this year there were breeding bird morning surveys taking place three times in April, May and June by Dan Haywood. And in total he reported 36 species of bird, and 32 of these were breeding. Now, some summer visitors which bred include the following warblers, which I won't show you pictures for because I want to try and keep to time. But we had black cap, chiff chaff, willow warbler, and white throat. Black caps sometimes don't migrate, and we get quite a lot in Britain over from Germany in winter. But these other birds, chiff chaff, willow warbler, and white throat, all come from sub-Saharan Africa, so they've got a long way to come. Now, Fairfield has service stations, is the next concept. Now, this is one of my wonderful photographs of birds. This is the arable field at a certain stage of its development. I think it was about April 15th. There it is. This is a better photograph that Dan Haywood took. And we had about two dozen of these birds on our arable field. A very handsome bird. This bird weighs about 25 grams, just a little bit more than a 2-pound piece. But these birds winter in sub-Saharan Africa, all of them, and they migrate huge distances. So here we are in the Sahel, which is the area south of the Sahara, where most of our summer birds come from. And despite the fact that these birds winter in sub-Saharan Africa, they're found through about 320 degrees circumference of the globe. So one lot head off to Canada, and it was probably, obviously we have northern wheatears in Britain here, but we believe that the birds we saw were on their way to Canada, that they were this group here, rather than the other group that start off near the Ethiopian end and head off to Alaska. So Fairfield is quite important just as a staging post for birds. So we had about two dozen in Fairfield, and we believe they were kind of abound. They're slightly sturdier birds than the ones that we have, but as you can see, they make a tidy journey. Other migrants. Now, in an area like Fairfield, although some birds may be travelling a long way from sub-Saharan Africa, other birds might just be moving from the uplands to somewhere a bit warmer, or vice versa. And some of these species may migrate quite short distances. I was quite surprised. I couldn't work out what this was at first, because it's not the sort of bird you expect. You know, this is a stonechat, and you see that on the top of a gorse bush in an upland heath, by and large. But we saw two or three of these in, I think it was late March, in Fairfield. And then other birds that just passing through were redpoll and siskin. So these birds you might see in Fairfield, but they're actually moving from one environment to another, but they're passing through. The most exciting birding bit for me this year was on the 24th of March. I happened to take my binoculars into the garden, looked up, and I was only out of the garden for 5 minutes, and I saw an osprey who wheeled twice over the school ponds, decided it wasn't for really. It wasn't right for it, and it headed off north, presumably to Scotland. And it was actually the first sighting of an osprey in Lancashire this year. So these birds, which are in quite good numbers now in Scotland and to some extent in the Lake District in Wales, do tend to fly up past Lancaster. They, in their fly zones, they, I think they quite like to see the coast when they're migrating. And so Lancaster's a good place, if you're lucky, to see a bird like this passing through. Now, I'm going to conclude with a few birds you might see in Fairfield, and I've chosen ones that are colourful looking. And there's the green finch. You see these quite often around the orchard. Again, the bullfinch around the orchard. The jay is a very handsome bird. They've been tucking into our Copper Beech moss this last week. They've been climbing all over the tree. Presumably, they do collect beech moss and acorns, which no doubt they bury somewhere cunningly. Great spotted woodpecker. Although we had a sad tale this year where we found the feather of one of these that looked as if a sparrowhawk had got it. So I'm not quite sure what the state of our population is there. And of course the green bunting, which is another handsome bird, particularly if you're able to identify the males. And this is a picture that I took in actually Spain last year. It's an occasion where I managed to capture the whole bird. And we were actually looking for completely different birds. We were looking for a bird called Aurora. And they'd set up nest boxes like this, just as we've now set up in Fairfield for the little owl. And most of the nest boxes they'd set up for rovers have been occupied by little owls and by the lesser kestrels. But this is a bird we hope to attract into Fairfield. We know that we have a few of them in the Admiralty Wood, and we've got three boxes set up that we would hope to attract little owls into Fairfield. So, to conclude, I really need to acknowledge the true bird experts like Richard Staunton from the RSPB, who's been responsible for advising us with Natural England and coming up with a whole plan for the works that have led to this. And you must remember that it's only a year ago that we got the last field, so it was still very early days of trying to understand how the whole of Fairfield is going to work. John Carter also works at the RSPB. He's led a number of walks through Fairfield during the year and will lead some more later on in the year. And Dan Haywood has carried out the breeding bird surveys. And finally, of course, we really need to thank all the volunteers who have developed and maintained this preserve. Thank you.
Bunticles of land, magpies, and grey squirrels. I live on the hill, and I'm very blessed with our trees behind us. It's rather like the Amazonian jungle for wildlife, including jays.
Yeah.
I see the squirrels predating. I've seen the magpies tearing squirrels to bits. I see the squirrels raiding birds' nests and eating the young. And when we go down to Florida, we sit there quite a bit, quietly watching the swallows and the swifts. And the magpies, there's about six of them,
Yep.
And I'm thinking that I've got a lot of these nests. Because they all die in a certain area.
Yeah.
And all the health screws do, like, which breaks out. And I often say to my wife, how will these birds survive?
Yes, I certainly counted a group of six magpies when I walked through yesterday. They are in large numbers. So one of our 248 birds is doing very well. I don't know what to say about that. But
they seem to be increasing in expensive.
Yes. Yes, I think they are a successful member of the crow family. But you see, actually, if you look at the green list of birds, it's quite heavily populated by various members of the crow family. They're not the birds we identify with most strongly, but if you look at the number of birds that we've got, I think there are 23 species of bird in the country where we have over a million of them, and I think about five of those are types of crow.
Can I just add to the comment there? It's one of the reasons that we have to restrict the number of tall trees within the reserve, and also to keep the hedgerows quite low, because the magpies and crows will sit in the trees very patiently all day and watch the reed beds until a ground nesting bird starts to move, and then they'll know where the nest is. So part of our management plan is to reduce the height of trees and hedgerows.
Favourite spots is when you cross four and you're going towards Cromwell Road.
Yeah.
I watch it in Congreve, I have six of them, and that's where they went.
Yeah. Just opposite School Common.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think probably people have begun to realise the problems with the organochlorines. You know, DDT was introduced, I think the first time I came across it was reading Reader's Digest of 1944, I think it was. it was being used as weed killer at that stage. But they realised with the collapse of Kestrel numbers in particular, which of course goes high up the food chain, that both DDT and dieldrin, which are both organochlorine pesticides, were bad news. So they got banned and we moved into organophosphates, which weren't quite so bad. So we had a recovery, I think, in the post-organochlorine period. Sorry? Yes, it's very difficult because there are so many aspects of agricultural intensification, you know, draining the land, pesticide. It's very difficult to parse, you know, the individual factors. If you look at the different graphs, they're not all exactly the same. Some birds are collapsing, their numbers are collapsing around 1980, some of them in 1975, some of them later. I don't think anyone's actually able to completely work it out because of these intensification systems have been introduced quite rapidly, really.
In one of your early slides, you were talking about DDT and dieldrin.
Yeah.
And you said that they were pesticides. In fact, they said they were herbicides. In fact, they are pesticides. They have the same effect.
Yeah.
There were probably herbicides being put on at the same time,
yeah.
But not DDT. I think it's...
DDT was first introduced as a herbicide.
Well, they were killing insects.
But they found gradually that it had a number of different uses.
Right, well, I didn't know that. I thought there were other things that were herbicides.
I think in any case it was particularly the impact on the population of kestrels.
Yes,
that really,
but it killed them. It got into the bugs, and that affected their fertility.
Yes. And of course today we've got other substances which are being used, like the neonicotinoids, which seem to be having a very big impact on bee and bumblebee populations, and we don't know quite how that might move up the food chain.
Has it been possible to tag any of the birds that kind of travel through here? I mean, you mentioned one
osprey. Canada,
for instance.
Oh, the northern wheaters. Yeah, no, I don't think there hasn't been any such work on this site. No, but it would certainly be interesting if we did see any birds that were already tagged. I haven't seen any tagged birds in Fairfield myself.
Well, I was actually thinking not just tagging them, but actually planting TV cameras on them all.
We need a volunteer to do that.
No, I was wondering about you've got stuff which is stored in the garage.
I think they do a certain amount with some species. I think the British Trust for Ornithology does more of that kind of work because they're more the research arm of the birding community, and certainly they do it for a number of ospreys, they do it for cuckoos, and they're doing it for smaller birds as well now. I mean, there are even things being used on insects the size of bees now, that, you know, GPS location for something as small as that is impressive. But no, I'm not aware of any projects of that kind.
Some of the bird numbers were in numbers, others were white heritage. Can you explain?
I was afraid that wouldn't get along. Yeah, I don't really understand that. This is the way, I mean, sometimes they do it in pairs. I mean, obviously, I've tried to look this point up, and I don't actually understand. This is the way they're actually recorded in the VTO, the British Trust for Ornithology, or the British Birding Survey. But I don't really understand the distinction, because obviously all birds, when they're breeding, have a territory. So I don't know. It's just the way it's recorded, and I've just copied it off bird trends without really being able to get to the bottom of it.
Is it the territory the bird holds?
Well, the different birds, of course, hold different sizes of territory. You know, robin might have 0.1 acre, whereas a Mr. Thrush might have 125 acres. But I don't know quite why it's recorded in that way. Sorry?
Would that be worth
No, I think one of the advantages of someone like Dan Hayward, he knows birds' song very well. And I think obviously at that time of year, birds are singing quite a lot, either to get a mate or later when they've got a mate to hold a territory. And of course, having real facility with birds' song, it is a critical part of that. I didn't mention he did an additional survey, a dust survey, listening out, because thrushes tend to sing in the evening. So he did an additional survey in the evening. But yes, being able to, something I can't do, but I try to, you know, I can recognize a cuckoo and a chip-chap. And a missile thrush when it's at the bottom of Tim's garden. But I think if you're really musical, you have a really decent chance of...
He was counting absolute numbers, wasn't he?
Yes, he was counting absolute numbers. And of course, however good he is, he won't get everything. I think it must be very difficult. And I've no idea, you know, when you read that there's a British bird atlas that comes out every few years, and it's got about 100 pages on methodology and statistics and what have you. But for a lot of the birds, like snipe, for instance, the numbers are very uncertain. They're such skulking birds that you have great difficulty really knowing. I mean, they may well be on the red list and we just don't know about it.
3 years ago, more than one hour at night time on the show, we used to like to listen to them. And then, last year, we hardly heard any song. And I found the dead owl on the canal between the lodge and Deep Cutting. I don't think it's been a fox or a bird of prey, because it's usually fairly separate when it's there. And it's just an owl corpse. Could it be poison?
I'm sorry, I just don't know. Well, obviously, again, it's an animal that's at the top end of the food chain. So, you know, it might not have been deliberately poisoned, but it might represent some problem in the food chain as a whole. I don't know.
Going back to the owls, last year it was peculiar here. A friend of ours in Cheshire who's been very involved with owls and for many years, and he said, was it last year that the March was a superb month, or April. The early spring was so good that a high number of young owls being bred. But then that was followed by the very wet summer.
Yeah.
Again, it was really not this summer, not the winter, the summer. So, and the numbers plummeted because they can't cope with wet weather, can they?
Yeah.
So it started well and it just completely fizzled out. And whereas this year, they're doing very well.
Yes, I mean, these sorts of climate things can have a very major impact. Talking about birds that come to us in summer from the sub-Saharan area called the Sahel, well, in the 1970s, I think it was 77 or 78, there was a drought there. And many of our birds that come from there still haven't recovered in numbers. Because although there's nothing wrong with our environment, or the main thing wrong with our environment here, when they winter there, they can't feed. So quite a number of our summer visitors collapsed in numbers, and in many cases they still haven't recovered. So some of these effects can be very long-lasting.
Is it possible to breed red partridge chicks?
Yeah.
Because you can do pheasants. I know you can't do grouse.
Yeah, they do, and there is a breeding program in Lancashire, isn't there?
Yes, it was Neil Sutcliffe, who was a farmer who dealt with the arable field for us, and he has a farm at Cocosands. It's not in here, it's at Cocosands. He does a variety of things there. He has his own margins, wildflower margins, so he's interested in environmental issues, knows what he's doing, which is why Richard recommended him to us. But one of the things he does is have a shoot on some of his land, and so he's in contact with the breeders, and that's why his wife was able to bring a little cage of partridge chicks over for us. So we actually got them via the gaming. That sort of game bird, if you have a gaming community.
The reason I've seen them, on Pennant Marshes, I used to go bird watching, there is a very kind farmer, and he scatters grain down his track.
Yes.
And you can see all sorts of birds, and they're that 110. Mm. And I saw 10 great partridge at once. So if somebody feeds them, like you were saying, yeah, winter sowing, etc., he's sort of interfering with modern farming and throwing grain out.
Well, I mean, this is a relatively rich area for grey partridge, actually. But you see, in the past, there were a lot of gamekeepers who worked with grey partridge. There are fewer gamekeepers nowadays, and most of them have turned their efforts to pheasants. If you look at pheasants, their numbers are just going up. So, obviously, you've got a lot more meat on a pheasant than you have on a grey partridge.
Just
need
to get it.
Yes.
Dr. are cats a significant problem? I think there's a lot of houses rather close to the reserve, and cats are notorious, aren't they?
Yes, I think this is one of the things that the RSPB never mentioned, isn't it? It is probably one of those great risks. But I don't know. I don't know whether it's been quantified.
Related in a way, that Fairfield is surrounded on three sides at least by housing. Do we help by feeding in our backyards, or do we make things worse?
Well, I think we help. I mean, it depends also on the severity of winter. Birds like redwing and fieldfare, if they come over and there's, you know, snow around, they very much appreciate an old apple thrown out. I think there's quite a lot that can be done. I mean, you have to recognise that, I mean, 2 or 3 years back we had a very severe winter and a lot of the kingfishers, for instance, died. You find the bodies of some of them along the canal. And, you know, you've got to be conscious of helping, I think, particularly in those sorts of period. This year, of course, has been very bountiful in terms of berries and things, and they may similarly be in Scandinavia, for all I know, so I'm not aware yet that any, for instance, red wings and fieldfare have come over.
It's only as good as the other reserves around you, really. You know, you're very interconnected with other areas. And of course, this might be important in terms of other birds migrating. Bitterns, for instance, migrate quite extensively. And, you know, so seeing us as part of a corridor might be actually every bit as important as breeding success. Obviously, we have targets, which, as far as I can see, in tree sparrows, we don't appear to have achieved any target this year, and that is another bird on the red list. And certainly you do see tree sparrows around the northern end of the Westfield area. But whether... But Dan didn't seem to record any breeding pairs. But I think, you know, there's still scope for other birds like tree sparrows. But I don't see us getting into large numbers, but it's very satisfying to see, you know, any development in the right direction when you're dealing with so many birds that are red listed and vulnerable.
On the
on yes, we're seeing more hen and teal, mallard, and of course you often, in the school pond in winter, you quite often see as many as 5 snipe in there. And the snipe, I think we don't know very much about whether our snipe largely come here in winter, or what size of population we have throughout the year. I think we have some around now, don't we? I think some have been seen recently. But, so snipes obviously are very important bird. And I think there are other birds that we might attract to breed, like oyster catchers and curlew, for instance, are both birds that are in decline. And you can see them. I have seen them in the last 2 or 3 weeks in Fairfield, but it would be nice if there was scope for them to breed as well.
I think it's wonderful to say that
Yeah.
You've seen Curly.
Yeah, no, I've seen Curly last week in the field.
The purpose of the arable field is clearly to provide wintering feed and shelter. It seemed to be harvested relatively early this year. Wouldn't it be more productive for that purpose if one was rather less efficient, if you like, in the harvesting process? It might provide a bit more winter grain or herbaceous bill or whatever to keep things going.
Doesn't
it want
time?
Yeah, I think.
Basically, the arrangement we have with farmers and then the cost of green is important for us that we can be able to make things meet. So he does all the planning and sowing, sows our wildflower mining for us, although we pay for that wildflower. But he pays us a great deal. And he has to make a decent
profit. Oh, yeah, fair to his effects.
So that's the reason that he. The problem is that there's a returning effect of his cattle during the winter, and so the technique is to take the crop before it's completely ripe because it has a higher nutrient value
for feeding. Yes.
But actually, when he took the crop, he did also spill a fair amount of seed around.
Yeah, we walked through when the grey park chicks were released, and there was a lot of food around them still. It wasn't like a modern combine harvester where there wouldn't be anything left.
No, because he harvested using like a salvaging process.
Yeah. Richard thought
that.
Yeah.
Certainly, that food was modeled for some time, but it was but the other thing that we've done is to was quite an extensive area of the wildflower margin, which goes all the way around the field, which is full of fodder radish and acelia in particular, which is going to be left over winter, and the seed can dry up on that during the winter. And the area with all the white daisies in it, that's the site will soon now get mowed, and that will be taken off because that's what natural England wants to do. But the bird fangled seed will just stay there until the spring, and then once all the seed is gone from it, the farmer comes back to plant the land again in March, but then get ploughed the field around and proceed back into the land at that point. And we're expecting to get another wildflower margin from that field. So we're doing what we can, but we do have to operate within.
Ian's has quoted the bird surveys that we have from people in the RSPB, our birding experts, but obviously they're only snapshots, and as Ian said, that when Dan goes round, you'll miss things. So what we hope people will do is if they're going for a walk or taking their dog out or whatever, that they will start looking out for birds. And the way we record what we see is on the wildlife blog on the Fairfield website. Now, I know that, and please, if you are comfortable with entering things onto a blog, please, please continue to do that. If you're not, I was thinking about this since our meeting last night, if people are not comfortable about using a blog, or it's a technology that's new to them, then I'm quite happy to be the person who does that for you, or you may have a neighbour or whatever you tell it to, but otherwise I'm quite happy for people to email or contact me and I'll put it onto the blog for you. So that's one possibility, and just see me afterwards and take my email address or telephone number or whatever. The other thing about the blog, it doesn't have to be that you've seen a remonting, that's great, and you put it on the blog. It could be that you've seen a small bird with a black head and you didn't quite know what it was, because that is also useful, because our birding experts read the blog And they can then say, ah, right, well, we've had a reed bunting in Aldcliffe, and that's probably what it was. Or they will then go and look. So a blog can also be used for asking questions about something that you have seen. So you don't have to be an expert at identification. You don't have to be an expert at putting things on the blog, because certainly there are several of us who can help you with that. But it would be a really good facility. At the moment, I think there are about four of us who are putting sightings on. It would be nice to increase that.
Yeah, in relation to what Susan has said, the blog will also take photographs of the pattern. So if you see some bird in the barn, whatever it is, and you've got your camera with you, or your iPhone or whatever, then you can take a sample of it, and then you can see that report that's in your platform, and then be loading up on the site.
And what our web manager does, she goes through the blog every so often, and then she extracts all the things that have been seen. So she will have a heading, say, brown hairs, and the date when anyone has spotted a brown hair, for example. So it's becoming a very useful resource, and will become more useful if people would actually just put things down onto it. It doesn't have to be something you've never ever seen before. It's really nice if someone sees one of the greatest spotted woodpeckers, then we know the sparrow hawk didn't get all of them. I think they bred there this year. I think we saw a young chimpanzee, which was hopeful. Okay, with the no more comments or questions, I'd like to thank you for coming and doing the talk. And then I'd also to thank you, Ian. I'd just like to flag up next week. Next week is a very important week because it's the last talk in this lecture series. We started about a year ago when Nick and Hilary started things off by talking about how the Fairfield Association came to be running a nature reserve, and started off with, some many years ago now it seems, starting off with campaigning for the playground, which was the beginning. So I think it's very appropriate that our final lecture is going to be given by a younger member of our community who actually grew up in Fairfield and has very fond memories of playing on the playground. And she is going to look at the history of this area, drawing from the several history sessions that we've had and drawing the threads out of them. And going to do it, tell us a younger person, can't you? Because she's going to do it by doing a virtual walk around the reserve and tying the history into that. So I'm looking forward to that enormously. And it will be our final session. So I do hope that as many people as possible are able to come with that and really celebrate what's been going on with our younger colleague. Thank you very much.
Yeah.